So the Buddha said that being born as a human being is a really fortunate situation. We're kind of right in the middle of samsara, between the unfortunate realms, animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings, and the upper realms, the really high ones, the devas who have incredible bliss and happiness and very little, almost zero suffering and very long lives and, yeah, just divine enjoyments. So we're kind of in the middle between those two extremes. So we have some suffering in this world, even though it may seem horrible. It's not as bad as in the unfortunate realms. And we have some pleasure, which can seem pretty good sometimes, but it's nothing compared to the deva realms. So we have a chance to know suffering and to know pleasure, and it's really easy to recognize we don't want suffering, we want more pleasure, more happiness. So this is a sort of ideal situation for generating renunciation and starting to do what needs to be done in order to avoid suffering, like refraining from non-virtuous actions, and to create the causes of happiness, which is mainly virtuous actions. And we also have intelligent minds with which we can understand the bigger picture, the whole of samsara, and how, yeah, even if we get good rebirths, it's still suffering. It's still a kind of undesirable situation, like a prison, actually. We're not free. So then we can generate the wish to be free, to get out of samsara, and even better, to go all the way to full enlightenment, Buddhahood. So as human beings, we have this really ideal situation to be able to appreciate the Buddha's teachings, start to put them into practice. But not all human beings do have access to Buddha's teachings. So this is another reason that our lives are particularly special and fortunate. We do have the chance to learn the Buddha's teachings, and we have the karma to appreciate them and be interested in them and want to learn more and want to practice them. So we're really, really fortunate to have all the conditions that we have, and especially here in the Abbey, a little bit like an island of peace and calm in the midst of a lot of confusion and troubles right now in the world. So really appreciate the situation that we have, the conditions that we have, and want to make the best use of it. And the best way we can use our lives is to generate the wish to benefit others, altruism, and engage in the practice of Dharma, living ethically and studying and practicing, meditating as much as we can, and doing all this not just for ourselves, but for the benefit of others, for the benefit of all living beings. So really try to make sure that's your reason, your motivation for being here now, participating in this session. We are doing a review of the first few chapters of Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. There's different ways of translating that title, engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds, the way of awakening. So Bodhichayavatara in Sanskrit. And so far we reviewed the first chapter. And that chapter gives an introduction to bodhicitta, the aspiration to become a Buddha, fully enlightened being, for the benefit of all living beings. And that chapter also talked about the benefits of this state of mind, if we can generate this state of mind. So by hearing about the benefits of it, then hopefully we will be inspired to at least start cultivating bodhicitta. And I was thinking this morning about an experience that I had when I first started learning Buddhism. I kind of jumped in the deep end, studying with Tibetan lamas, very traditional teachings. And I was very inspired by bodhicitta. And that was one of the main things that drew me to Buddhism. But after a couple of years, kind of learning more about what's actually involved in becoming enlightened. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, I want to become enlightened, help all living beings. And I kind of thought, oh, yeah, I'll do that pretty soon, in a couple of years. But then the more I learned about it, the more I realized, wow, it's a big deal and it's going to take a long time. And also the more I looked at my own mind, got to know my own mind and all the incredible afflictive emotions in there, then the more far away it seemed. And I don't know at what point, but yeah, after a number of years of that, I attended a talk given by Lama Yeshe. It was a public talk in London. And he talked about bodhicitta, but the way he talked about it was much more kind of down to earth and practical. He said, you don't have to think about bodhicitta as helping all sentient beings. It's just you and the person in front of you, you know, just like being as kind and caring as you can to this person in front of you. Somehow, I don't remember the exact words, but that was the sort of gist of it. And I found that just so kind of much more realistic, much more doable. And so it kind of helped me to renew my inspiration to generate bodhicitta and follow this path. Yeah, so I just wanted to share that with you in case you've never heard that kind of explanation. Because, the full picture, the full story of bodhicitta can be like, and I don't know if I can do that. It sounds wonderful, it sounds beautiful, but me, little old me, doing that? But if we think about it as, just one step at a time, starting just being more kind and caring to the people around us, our friends and our family, our neighbors and people we work with and so on, just being more kind and caring and trying not to hurt them. I mean, that itself is a start going in that direction and try to be less selfish. Yeah, so even if we think of bodhicitta in that way, and I think it makes a lot of sense and it's very inspiring. And then chapter 2, we covered that last week in a pretty rushed way. That chapter was talking mainly about confession of our past negative actions, bringing to mind things that we have done that we recognize as harmful, feeling regret for them, and then feeling the strong wish to purify those and not do them again in the future. So that's a really, really, really important practice to do. It's important for a number of reasons. One is so we don't experience the terrible results that would come otherwise if we don't purify our negative actions. But in terms of this particular topic, bodhicitta, the bodhisattva's path, it's necessary to clear up our act, clean up our act, purify our bad karma, and also our habitual tendencies. You know, one of the results of doing a negative action is having the tendency to do it again and again and again. Like, the more you do it, the easier it gets. So it becomes a habit. So this is really, really important. If we do aspire to follow the bodhisattva's path, we want to generate positive attitudes and habits, habitual tendencies, and reduce the negative ones and eventually get beyond them altogether. So that was the main point of chapter 2, confession. And now chapter 3, in the translation I'm looking at by Tosugi, it's called Completely Upholding the Mind of Enlightenment. This is a little shorter than the last one. It has 34 verses. I might be able to get through it all this morning. If not, can continue next week. And so actually, chapters 2 and 3 contain all of the seven limbs. These are seven practices that are said to contain the most important points for purification of non-virtue, or negative actions of the past, and also accumulation of merit or positive energy. So these are two areas that we need to put a lot of effort in, especially in the beginning, but not just in the beginning, all the way. the Bodhisattva's path consists of especially accumulation of merit, positive energy, to be able to keep going on the path. So these are two things we need to work on continuously from the beginning up until enlightenment: purifying any mistakes, non-virtues, and accumulating positive energy or merit or virtue, whatever you want to call it, the positive side of the path. So it's said that there are these seven practices that are the most important practices to accomplish these two goals of purification and accumulation of merit. And so in chapter 2, in addition, so the seven limbs are, first of all, prostration, and then offerings, and then confession. So those three were actually included in chapter 2. So there were some verses related to prostration or paying homage with body, speech, and mind to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so on. And then offerings, there were all that verses with lots of wonderful, beautiful offerings, and that's a way of accumulating merit. So that was also included in chapter 2. And then, of course, confession. So now in chapter 3, we have the remainder of the seven limbs, the last four, which are rejoicing, requesting the Buddha to teach, requesting the Buddha to not pass away from this world, and then dedication of merit. So that those four limbs come at the beginning of chapter 3, and then it continues with other topics. So the first couple of verses, the first four verses of chapter 3 are about rejoicing. So rejoicing means feeling happy, feeling joyful about virtuous actions that have been done by other people, but also by oneself. And this is said to be a really excellent way of accumulating merit or virtue. It's virtuous to rejoice, as long as what we rejoice in was virtuous. It's not virtuous to rejoice in non-virtue, like people often do when a criminal in this country, when a criminal is being executed. Yeah, people rejoice in that. Yeah, good, they got what they deserved. So that's negative rejoicing. And it's also negative to rejoice any kind of violent, harmful, negative action, even if we feel it was justified, like if our country is fighting another country and we managed to kill a bunch of people or knock out the leader, we may think, well, that's good, isn't it? Well, it's not good in the sense that it was a harmful action to do, it was a negative action to do, and that those people who were killed, suffer. So we should be careful not to rejoice in those kind of things. So instead, we rejoice in virtuous actions. Okay, so when we see somebody making offerings, for example, or studying or meditating or helping somebody. So there's lots of actions like this. Here in the Abbey, every day people are doing a lot of virtue, and out there in the world, the frontline workers, the medical workers, the people who are trying to relieve the suffering of others, hunger, homelessness, anxiety, depression, and of course COVID and all the other kind of sicknesses. So there's hundreds, thousands of millions of people out there every single day, 24 hours a day, doing this kind of thing. And then, of course, all the spiritual practitioners, whether they're Buddhist or any religion, those who are sincerely living according to the teachings of their religion, living ethically, praying, meditating, working on their minds, helping others. So these are just examples of things to rejoice in. But we also need to rejoice in our own virtue, the good things that we do. We sometimes neglect to do that. And sometimes we even do the opposite of that. You know, we sort of beat ourselves up because we didn't do enough. We didn't do a good job. We spent a half an hour meditating, but our mind was all over the place. And then we beat ourselves up instead of rejoicing that we at least tried to do it. So we tend to be hard on ourselves, we Westerners. And so rejoicing is a really good antidote to that self-criticalness, self-judgmentalness, low self-esteem, all of those kind of things. So I had to learn this myself. It took a long time before I could learn to start rejoicing in myself. Another thing we may think, but isn't that pride? Isn't that ego? Isn't that, you know, being full of yourself? I mean, there's a difference between pride and arrogance and just plain rejoicing. Pride and arrogance is more when we feel, I'm better than others. Wow, I'm so great. Look at me, and I'm better than others. I do more than others. So that's not rejoicing. Rejoicing is, oh, I got up this morning, and I, you know, made some offerings on my altar, and then I sat down, and I did some prayers and practices, and wow, that's a good thing. I'm glad I did that. And I'm keeping vows. I'm wearing these robes and keeping vows, and I'm trying to do good things every day. This is good. I'm doing good. So, you know, it's not about comparing ourselves with others and feeling better than others, but just rejoicing, feeling good about the good we are doing. We need to do that to give ourselves encouragement. Otherwise, if we keep beating ourselves up, if we're hard on ourselves, always criticizing ourselves, eventually we may give up altogether. We may feel, ah, oh, this is too hard. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to go back to what I was doing before. So it's really, really important to learn to rejoice in our own good actions and our good efforts, and always strive to do better. Yeah, try to get our mind more under control and our ethical practice better. But just the fact that we are trying is really important to appreciate about ourselves. And then, of course, lots of other people's activities to rejoice in. So I'll just read these verses. With joy, I rejoice in the virtue that relieves the suffering of unfortunate rebirths of all sentient beings and in the abiding and happiness of those subject to suffering. So this verse is about rejoicing in the actions that will bring about fortunate rebirths in future lives, like ethical conduct, refraining from the 10 non-virtuous actions and other kinds of non-virtuous actions, and doing virtuous actions. So that kind of practice that will lead to fortunate rebirths and happiness and good experiences in the future, and not unfortunate circumstances like being born in the three lower realms. So any kind of virtue that comes under that category, whether it's done by yourself, done by others, being happy about that. Because we want people to not suffer, and we want them to be happy. So they have to create the causes for that. It's not going to happen if they don't create the virtue that will lead to suffering and refrain from the non-virtue that leads to We want them to create the virtue that leads to happiness and refrain from the virtue that leads to suffering. So when anyone's doing that, that's worthy of rejoicing. And then the next verse says, I rejoice in that accumulation of virtue that is the cause for enlightenment. And here the commentary said, this is specifically talking about the hearers and solitary realizers' enlightenment, because their goals are also sometimes called enlightenment. So the hearers and the solitary realizers who are striving for liberation, so when they start going in that direction, creating the causes to attain their respective enlightenments, rejoicing in that. And then it says, I rejoice in the definite liberation of embodied creatures from the suffering of cyclic existence. So when they have gone all the way to their goals of nirvana or liberation from samsara, wow, how fantastic, I rejoice in that. So this is really important too, because sometimes we maybe get this sense that, oh, we're on the Mahayana path, we're aiming for enlightenment, and yeah, that's not such an ideal situation, the striving just for one's own liberation. We can be a little bit arrogant about that. We have to avoid that. That is fantastic. Anybody who wants to attain nirvana, liberation from samsara, that is really, really wonderful, really fantastic. We should rejoice that there are people doing that. And then the third verse, I rejoice in the enlightenment of the protectors and also in the grounds of their children. So this is talking specifically about the bodhisattva path. So those who are striving to follow that path and doing what they need to do to progress along the path and eventually reach the state of full enlightenment. So this is talking about Buddhahood, enlightenment, and the bodhisattvas. So all the activities related to that, the bodhisattva path, the attainment of enlightenment, I rejoice in all of those activities. With joy, I rejoice in the ocean of virtue of generating the mind of enlightenment that causes all sentient beings happiness, as well as in the deeds that benefit sentient beings. So this text is specifically about generating bodhicitta and following the bodhisattva's path. So any effort anyone makes to try to generate bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, and then engage in bodhisattva's deeds, bodhisattva's actions for that goal of enlightenment, but also benefiting sentient beings along the way. So when we generate bodhicitta and engage in bodhisattva's actions, of course, these are the cause for the long-term goal of enlightenment, but they're also beneficial right now. From this moment, we are benefiting others. So ourselves and anyone who's trying to do these things, these are actions that are really worthy of rejoicing. And then the next two verses are about the next two of the seven limbs, beseeching the Buddhas to teach the Dharma. This is a remedy to an action called abandoning the Dharma. So that can happen if we have any, if we reject the Dharma, we have negative thoughts or speak negatively about the Dharma, then that's, you know, something very non-virtuous. So as a remedy to that, there's this request that the Dharma be taught. So that's in verse 5. It says, with folded hands, I beseech the Buddhas of all directions to shine the lamp of Dharma for all bewildered in the darkness of suffering. So we're asking all the Buddhas to teach the Dharma. We actually don't have to do that because they're going to teach the Dharma whether we ask it or not. That's their whole purpose of becoming enlightened, is to teach the Dharma and help sentient beings get out of samsara. But still, we have to have that attitude of appreciation of the Dharma and really value how precious the Dharma is. Otherwise, it's easy to sort of slip into complacency, you know, especially nowadays. There's just so many books available and so many teachings available online and, you know, so many Buddhist centers. We can't go to them right now, but at least we can access them and get teachings online. So 24 hours a day, you know, we could be reading and listening to Dharma teachings. So it's possible after a while to get a bit maybe complacent, not appreciate the Dharma so much because there's so much available. But we have to be careful of that and really keep in mind how precious the Dharma is and not become bored with it or complacent about it. But, you know, We also have to avoid going overboard. That happens sometimes too, if people sometimes spend too much time reading and listening and meditating and so on, then they might get lunged out. I don't know, you've heard about lung. So we have to be careful about that. Do it in a balanced way. Take breaks sometimes, go for walks. Anyway, so it is important that we request the Buddhas to continue to teach the Dharma as long as there's still sentient beings in samsara, and help them emerge from that. And then the next verse is requesting that the Buddhas remain and not pass into nirvana. Again, that's something they're going to do anyway. We don't really have to ask them, but it's good for us to make that request, just to appreciate how precious it is that there are Buddhas and teachers in the world teaching us the Dharma. So it says, with folded hands, I beseech the victors, Buddhas, who wish to enter nirvana, not to leave migrating beings in blindness and to remain for countless eons. Okay, so then the last of the seven limbs is dedication, dedicating the merit that we accumulate. And I've also heard, it's not always expressed, but when we do dedicate merit, we can also dedicate the merit of others. I find that helpful because I tend to think, I'm kind of low, I have low self-esteem, so I tend to think, oh, I haven't accumulated much merit. But if I can dedicate the merit of others as well, especially the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, wow, that's a lot of merit. That kind of gives me enthusiasm. So yeah, they say we can dedicate the merit not only of ourselves, but of other people, other beings, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which is a huge amount of merit. So that's something you can think of when dedicating merit. And the best dedication of merit is to enlightenment, to Buddhahood. So the next four verses are related to that, dedicating the merit of the seven limbs, the previous six limbs that were just done, but any other merit that we create as well. Every day we're creating some merit just by keeping vows, just keeping precepts is so beneficial, so meritorious. So we always have merit that we can dedicate, and we need to make sure we dedicate it, because otherwise there's a danger that it could be lost if we get angry or generate wrong views. So we really want to make sure that doesn't happen. That's like leaving your money around, you know, going to a cafe or something and then just putting your money, your wallet there on the table and going to the bathroom. So that's dangerous. So we want to make sure that the merit we create is protected from being stolen, not really stolen, but lost, destroyed by getting angry. So that's why it's so important to dedicate to enlightenment. Thus, by the virtue accumulated through all that I have done, may all the suffering of all sentient beings be dispelled. So he's dedicating it for all sentient beings to be free from all their suffering. May I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick migrating beings in the world until their sicknesses are healed. So that's really appropriate at this point in time, imagining oneself as a doctor and a nurse taking care of all the people suffering from COVID and other diseases. May a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the suffering of thirst and hunger. And during the eon of famine, may I myself turn into food and drink. So they say that in the cycle of, you know, universes coming into existence, going out of existence, there are times when there's just no food and drink available. So people, beings are suffering from famine, but that can happen. It's happening right now in some places in the world. People are just not able to get enough to eat. So it's really beautiful to imagine, may I myself turn into food and drink and feed those who are hungry and thirsty. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into various articles of all necessities and abide close before them. So, yeah, Shantideva's text this chapter, and also chapter 10, the dedication chapter, just full of these beautiful verses, as we know. Star-Spangled Compassion. It's very, very inspiring. And it's typical of bodhisattvas to make these kind of prayers and aspirations about how they want to help sentient beings now and in the future. And I read something in Geshe Yeshe Thobten's commentary, The Way of Awakening. Where he says, someone once said to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Bodhisattva's prayers are so sublime that it seems unlikely that they can become reality. What is their purpose? The Dalai Lama answered that, although it is impossible to realize most of them, these prayers expand the mind of the bodhisattvas and encourage them on the path. Training one's mind is important, and a bodhisattva will do it so completely that he will later on acquire the attitude of being able to do anything. So, I don't know, for me it's helpful to just, His Holiness's way of saying things is kind of very practical. And yeah, maybe it's true that some of these prayers will never actually happen, but just to make these prayers, just to have these thoughts, these aspirations, how wonderful if I could turn my body into food and drink that rains down on all sentient beings all over the universe. Well, maybe I won't be able to do that, but just to have that thought is amazing, is beautiful. And it, like he says, it expands your mind, expands your heart. And then you're really thinking about sentient beings and the suffering they have, and you really want to relieve that suffering. And oh, how wonderful if I could do this. Yeah. So it's just a way of enhancing the compassion, the love, the dedication to benefiting others. So I guess the way I think of it is, don't worry about taking it too literally, you know. but just see it as an exercise, a training in the mind of compassion and love and generosity. And the next verses continue with this as well. And in the commentary, it says these verses are related to the perfection of giving, the first perfection. Because it's interesting, in the book itself, there is a chapter for each of the other perfections, except the first one, perfection of giving. So there's, you know, perfection of patience, of course, chapter 6, and so on. So all the other perfections are dealt with quite extensively, but there isn't a chapter just about giving. So some verses in this chapter can be found about giving, and then in chapter 10 as well, where it talks about giving your body and providing whatever is needed to sentient beings. So the next verse, number 11, the commentaries say, this verse is training one's mind to be able to practice giving, getting familiar with the whole idea of practicing giving. So it says, without any sense of loss, I shall give my body and resources as well as my virtues of the three times for the sake of accomplishing the welfare of all sentient beings. So it said that what we can give, the things that we can give, include our body, our own body, and our resources, money and whatever it is we may have, clothes, food. So these are things we can give. That's more like material giving. That we can also give our virtues. So the virtue, the merit, the good karma that we create, we can also dedicate that to others. It's not really possible to give virtue away. I mean, you know, each person is responsible for their own karma. Can't transfer karma from one person to another. But still, to have the wish to do that, I would like to give my merit to others, my virtue to others, so that it brings happiness for them. So again, this is a way of of accumulating, enhancing compassion and love. But also when we dedicate our merits to enlightenment, that is a way of giving our merits to others. By these merits, may I progress along the Bodhisattva path and become more and more able to help others and eventually become a Buddha, be able to help all others in the best way. So that itself is a way of giving our merits away to others, rather than, I want to keep these all for myself and just for my own happiness. And the next verse, number 12, explains the reason or the benefit of giving everything to others. It says, by giving all, I shall transcend sorrow and my mind will accomplish nirvana. Nirvana here means enlightenment, because that is a kind of nirvana. It is the ultimate nirvana. It's actually called non-abiding nirvana. The enlightenment of a Buddha is called non-abiding nirvana. Do you know why? Why is it called that? Two extremes of
samsara or nirvana.
Yeah.
Or so.
Yeah. So the Buddha's enlightenment is called non-abiding nirvana because it doesn't abide. The Buddha's enlightenment, nirvana, doesn't abide in these two other states, samsara, of course, doesn't abide in samsara. But the other one is nirvana, the nirvana of the hearers and solitary realizes, which is sometimes called solitary peace or self, you know, just attaining peace, nirvana for oneself without wanting to go on and help all other sentient beings. So bodhisattva, all along the path, this is what they're striving for. They want to avoid those two. Yeah, you can call them two extremes. The extreme of samsara, oh, that's the ocean of suffering. I want to avoid that. But the other extreme is self-liberation or solitary peace, attaining nirvana just for oneself. So the enlightenment of a Buddha doesn't abide in those two. So that's what's referred to here. He's saying, by giving away everything, I will get out of suffering and will attain nirvana, the ultimate nirvana of Buddhahood. All will be given similarly. It is best that I give to all sentient beings. So one of the commentaries says it's appropriate to give everything to sentient beings because they are the best field of generosity. Field, you know, in the sense that we plant seeds, just as we plant seeds in a field that will bring crops later on, vegetables and so on. So by giving to sentient beings, this is like planting seeds that will produce the good results of progressing along the bodhisattva's path and reaching enlightenment. Because they need it. They need so much. I mean, it's wonderful to make offerings to the Buddhas and bodhisattvas, of course, but they don't really need our offerings. So sentient beings are hungry and thirsty and poor and homeless and cold and sick, and you know, they're really in need. So it's very, very important to practice giving to them. And in Geshe Yeshe Thupten's commentary, he says there's two reasons that it makes sense to offer everything to sentient beings. One reason is it's like investing our money in order to gain profit. Just like we, you know, if you have some extra money, then most people, well, people who are farsighted, will put at least some of their money into some investment, stocks or bonds or whatever, at least a bank account that has interest, so that your money will grow. So giving things to sentient beings is like that. It's investing our merit in order to gain long-term goals of liberation and enlightenment. And the second reason is we have to leave everything behind anyway when we die. We can't take any of it with us. So it's better to give things now with a meaning, you know, for a meaningful goal, a meaningful purpose for the attainment of enlightenment, rather than, you know, at the time of death and having to just leave everything behind without any meaningful purpose. So, you know, everybody has to leave their stuff behind when they die, but often they're still grasping at them, still concerned about their things and reluctant about leaving them behind. So we don't want to be like that. So it's better to really start giving things away now, or at least make a will so you don't have to think about that at the time of death. Give away things to others. And this is done with a, you know, for a meaningful purpose for the attainment of enlightenment. So the next two verses are kind of tricky. Verse 13 and 14, they say, having already given this body as what makes them happy, for the pleasure of all embodied beings, depending on what pleases them, constantly killing, abusing, or beating it, although they may play with my body and make it a basis of jest and blame, because I have already given this body of mine to them, why do I act with concern? So he's saying, we, you know, we're giving away our body, so we should let sentient beings do whatever they want, even killing, abusing, beating, making fun of me, and so on. So my guess is probably different people would have different responses to these verses depending on different factors, such as their, you know, culture, social factors, family, ethnic, also gender, life experiences, and of course our individual karma. So depending on all these different factors, when we hear these verses, read these verses, we might have different reactions. And I was thinking somebody who was raised Christian might think, oh yes, that's what I want to do, just like Jesus. He patiently put up with all those horrible things that people did to him, you know, beating him, whipping him, insulting him, nailing him to the cross. Yeah, I want to be like that. They can do whatever they want with my body. That will be wonderful. On the other hand, a woman who may have experienced sexual abuse or domestic violence might be like horrified, completely shocked, and even put off. You mean, in order to follow the Bodhisattva path, I have to let my husband or my boyfriend beat me up all the time? Let myself get raped? And maybe a person of color in this country might wonder, so does that mean I have to let the police and the vigilantes do whatever they want to me, to my family, my friends? So I think for one thing, Shanti Deva is saying this about himself. He's saying, this is my attitude. I am doing this. I am giving my body and let them do whatever they want to me. So he's saying that about himself. He's not saying you have to be this way too. Everybody, all people of all genders and all races, all of you have to think that way. He's not saying that. So this is something we can take on voluntarily or not. And also I was thinking how later in the text he talks about, I forget which chapter it is, but he's saying, you know, there's no need to worry about any problem. You know, if there's a problem that we encounter, and if there's a remedy to the problem, we can follow that remedy. And if there is no remedy, we should just accept it. So no need to worry or be unhappy. And, you know, we can take that to mean that, for example, if somebody is approaching me with a harmful intent, wanting to stab me or rape me or whatever, I don't have to just stand there and let it happen. I can do something, run away. I've heard this holiness say that. If somebody came to me and wanted to hurt me, I'd run away. So I don't think we have to take this verse to mean, yes, do whatever you want with me, necessarily. I mean, you might choose to do that, but not necessarily. So I don't think we should take these verses to mean that necessarily we have to be like a doormat and let people walk all over us and abuse us and do whatever they want, mistreat us. Also, there's the karma. If we're letting people behave that way, is that really good for them? Is that really kind and compassionate to let people engage in such misbehavior? So I was looking at the different commentaries to see what they say about this, and most of them that I saw, they just pretty much affirm Shantideva's message. And I was wondering what Pema Chodron would have to say. Being an American, a female, contemporary. So I'll just read what she says. She said, "When I first read these verses, I was appalled. I didn't want to consider going this far, nor did I feel it was wise to do so. From a Western perspective, this advice seems to feed right into the self-loathing so prevalent in our culture." So that's one thing we have to be careful about as well. You know, this is why some women get trapped into abusive relationships, because they think, "I don't deserve any better." So that's definitely not where Shantideva is coming from. But knowing that Shantideva's intention is to always support and encourage us, I looked past my initial aversion and discovered the wisdom of his words. This, I realized, was the approach of the civil rights workers. In order to benefit not only African Americans, but also their oppressors, they were willing to put their bodies and feelings on the line. For the greater good, they entered into dangerous situations. Being the butt of every mockery, which is another way of translating, letting people make fun of me, was the least of it. They knew they would be beaten, insulted, and perhaps killed. This is an example of bodhisattva wisdom and courage. Yet these were just ordinary people who had given birth to the Bodhi heart. These verses describe what many famous bodhisattvas were willing to go through, people like Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, Aung San Suu Kyi, and Gandhi. It also describes the bravery of countless unsung heroes and heroines. So I thought that was a nice way of thinking about it, you know, that there are these people, even now, who are willing to put their lives on the line for the benefit of others. And in Geshe Yeshe Thupten's commentary, he said, "We need discrimination in offering our bodies. We must act wisely in each situation, considering whether our gift will be beneficial or harmful. If the benefits amount to more than the harm, if there's more good than harm, then it's appropriate to do so. Otherwise, it's not a good idea." So we have to use wisdom to decide what will be most beneficial in each situation and not just be, you know, careless and blind about giving things away. And they also do say, I think, you know, there's all these stories about bodhisattvas giving their bodies, like the Buddha in a previous life giving his body to the mother tigress and her cubs. So they say, you know, you shouldn't do that too soon, too early in the path. Not a good idea to throw your body away before your mind is not kind of highly developed. So, you know, I think a bodhisattva, have uncontrived bodhicitta. I think that's the minimum requirement to just give your body away. And some other thoughts that I had were, to think of it as overcoming attachment to our body and also identifying with our body. So having a lot of attachment to our body and identifying with our body can become the cause of a lot of suffering and negativity. It can lead to anger, it can lead to violence. You know, people can get infuriated when somebody just bumps them, you know, or says something insulting, or looks at them in an insulting way. People can just get incredibly angry and even do something violent. I remember this story I heard of one man in North Carolina. He was a Dharma practitioner, and he was also going into prisons and teaching meditation to prisoners. And he had a son who was only about 21 years old, who got murdered in a particularly horrible way. The son went into a bar, and I don't remember exactly what happened. He bumped into somebody, I think, and caused this other guy to spill his drink. Yeah. And he apologized, you know, I'm really, really sorry, and da-da-da-da-da. And then the son went into the men's room, and the other guy followed him, pulled out a knife, and stabbed him to death. Now, and I was thinking about it, maybe there's more to it than just, you spilled my drink, because the victim was black, and this is North Carolina, so there may have been some racial attitudes involved as well. May not, you know, if the guy had been white, maybe it wouldn't have happened. I don't know. But still, it just shows what extremes people can go to, you know, out of attachment to their body and their things. And yeah. So that's something to look at in our mind, you know, and how we feel if somebody bumps us or looks at us with a look of disgust, or says something, wow, you're really fat, or whatever, you know, and do we get angry, do we get upset, okay? So that's something we need to work on. This is a place where we can start, you know, start working on overcoming attachment and identification with our body, and then gradually, you know, work on that more and more, and get to where we're willing to maybe give blood or donate, be an organ donor. So slowly, slowly, you know, we can build up our courage, our, you know, like decrease our attachment to our body and build up our courage about, you know, even giving away our body. So I didn't attend when Venerable Children was talking about these verses. I think I was cooking that day, so I was kind of in and out, and I didn't hear everything she said. Did she say anything else about these verses that were helpful?
She has she says that this could be a real trigger for many of us if we've had abuse in our life, but Chandideva, why is he saying these things? The precondition is the need to be free from samsara, which is to free us from these five aggregates and its suffering. They are the major cause of suffering. So if we're going to be able to generate renunciation from samsara, you know, and to really imagine sentient beings using our bodies for whatever they need, I want to rid myself of these aggregates. And this is a way for that to happen and be happy about it. What kind of freedom would I have if I could do this, to not be so attached to the aggregates that hold me and bind me? It was one of the ways to look at this.
I think each person can take it as works for them, as they are able to do, and just try to move more and more in the direction of not having any attachment. But we do also have to think about other sentient beings. And I mean, that's one of the things I find hard about these verses is, oh, let them kill me, let them beat me. But aren't they creating bad karma by doing that? Is that really good for them? Because if they get away with beating me, then they might go and do it to somebody else. So that's another consideration. But then when there's no choice, for example, the Tibetans who were in prison and couldn't run away or defend themselves, then these verses may have been very helpful for them.
You know, I think that these verses can be helpful after the fact. So if you've been suffered abused at some point in your life and you're trying to heal from that, contemplating these verses can help generate some level of healing in understanding, you know, how I can look at my body and a situation in a way that is more positive and bring myself into a frame of mind of generosity. But that's, I think, after we have really emotionally gotten over the incident. But I know that for me, when I look at some of these verses, it's been very helpful in overcoming my own situation.
Anyone else have anything to add or ask? Or I think too, yeah, I just thought of Jesus this morning. I hadn't thought of that before, but yeah, that's like a good example of someone who really did have no attachment to his body and just went through those experiences with patience and with compassion, forgiveness towards those who were persecuting him in that way. And then as Pema Chodron mentions, lots of other examples as well. The civil rights workers, I mean, that's extraordinary. I don't think I heard of John Lewis before he died. I may have heard his name, but yeah, just reading about him. I mean, he was on that bus. What did they call it? The Freedom Riders. He would get beaten up, and then he'd just get right back on the bus. You know, put in jail, back on the bus. I think he even had a concussion and was in the hospital, back on the bus. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary. And they were dedicated, at least some of them were just totally dedicated to nonviolence, no matter what happened to them. They were not going to react in any kind of violent way. And they were so determined, this cause that they had. Really incredible courage. Okay, so next verse, 15. I shall make it do whatever action that will not cause any harm. When anyone encounters me, may it never be meaningless for him. So some of the commentaries say what this means is I will use my body in ways that will not harm others. I will use my body in a completely non-harmful way. But other translations translated that those first two lines differently and talked about I will not let my body be used by others that will cause them harm. So that way it's more like, well, let others do what they want, but not in any way that would harm them. So I don't know, that for me that's more comfortable. I don't want them to be harmed. So may they not do anything that will be harmful for them. So yeah, if you just let somebody kill you or beat you or rape you or whatever, but if that's going to lead to suffering for them, they're going to be put into prison and they're creating all this bad karma, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. So it seems there's different ways of looking at this verse. But definitely one's own body should be used in non-harmful ways, making that commitment, I will not do anything harmful with my body. And then this second two lines, any encounter that others have with me, any time others meet me or see me. I love that verse in the Chenrezig practice. May anyone who merely sees me or... all of the above. Yeah, anyone encountering me in any possible way, even just seeing my photograph or hearing my name or whatever, may that be beneficial for them. That's so beautiful. Really wonderful. And then this continues in the next verses. Number 16, if in those who encounter me a faithful or an angry mind arises, may that eternally become the cause for fulfilling all their aims. So this is saying, you know, don't expect everyone to like you, to have positive thoughts and feelings about you. They may dislike you or get angry at you. That's okay. May even that be beneficial for them. They tell this story, I don't know if you've heard this story, some bodhisattva in Tibet who was always trying to make connections with people so that he could benefit them. And there was one woman in the town who was kind of a grumpy old woman and didn't want to have anything to do with him, so he wasn't able to sort of get through to her. So he got on his horse and was riding back and forth in front of her house on his horse, you know, to get her to notice him. I guess she came out and she was angry, you know. But at least she, you know, connected. There was some connection there. So they say, even if it's a kind of angry connection, then it can still be beneficial. because the being is a bodhisattva. And then having that connection means in a future life they'll meet again and the bodhisattva will be able to benefit that person. So I think, yeah, bodhisattva likes to connect with others. So yeah, if you have that motivation for going on Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever these other social media, I want to connect with others to benefit them, then that's good. May all who say bad things to me or cause me any other harm, and those who mock and insult me, have the fortune to become enlightened. So Bodhisattva doesn't mind being insulted or mocked or made fun of. May that be a cause for them to reach enlightenment. Amazing. And then there's more verses of these wishes about helping others. May I be a protector for those without one, a helmsman for travelers, and a ship, a boat, and a bridge for all who wish to cross. May I be an island for those who seek one, and a lamp for those desiring one. May I be a bed for all who desire one, and a slave for all who want an embodied slave. Yeah, slave. That's a trigger, right? I don't know what. Maybe it could be translated as servant. Yeah. Oh, it says, for all who need a servant, may I be their slave. Well, let's say servant. It's a little less triggering than slave. I mean, maybe in ancient India, slaves were not treated as horribly as they were in this country. That's kind of hard to wish to be a slave, but servant is more manageable. May I be a servant? May I serve others? Here we offer service every day. So that's the point. The point is to serve others with kindness and compassion, be attentive to their needs and wishes, and be there for them. May I be a wish-fulfilling jewel, a good vase, vase, knowledge mantras that accomplish and great medicine. May I become a wish-fulfilling tree and a wish-fulfilling cow for embodied beings. That's in the mandala, this wish-fulfilling cow that's continuously giving milk and butter and cheese and yogurt and all these ice cream. All these yummy things. Well, chocolate too. Chocolate, milk chocolate especially requires some milk. So yeah, just being able to provide whatever is needed for sentient beings. Just like the great elements such as earth and like space, may I always be many varieties of bases of sustenance for the boundless sentient beings. Likewise, until all attain nirvana, may I also be the source of sustenance for all the realms of sentient beings that reach into the ends of space. So I was thinking that with this verse number 21, talking about the great elements, just like the great elements, may I be whatever is needed for sentient beings. Lama Rinpoche composed a meditation about this, and I thought it might be nice to do it. It's not too long, and it's quite beautiful. So basically, you imagine the elements of your body, one at a time, earth and so on, absorbing into the external earth element, and then providing for the needs of sentient beings. It's quite beautiful, so I thought, let's do that together. So make yourselves comfortable and settle the mind. Remember the motivation, wanting to benefit all living beings. To do that, we need to work on overcoming ego, self-centeredness, attachment to our body and our other things, and increase our heart of giving, generosity, and kindness and compassion. So that's the purpose of this meditation. So inspired by this verse from Shantideva, which says, just like space and the great elements such as earth, water, fire, and air, may I always support the lives of all the boundless creatures. So first think about the earth element of your body, and this is the quality of solidity. For example, our bones and teeth have a lot of earth element in them. But it's also present in all the parts of our body. For example, our skin. We have earth element in our skin, in our organs, and so on. So all that quality of hardness or solidity in our body. So imagine that going out and absorbing into the external earth element. So that quality of hardness, solidity existing in the world around us. And then think of how the earth element is used by beings in different ways for their survival and their happiness. And feel that your earth element, which is now part of the external earth element, is providing these different ways for sentient beings to be happy. It's used as fields to grow the food people need to eat. It becomes beautiful parks and forests, which are homes for birds and animals, and are also places where people can go to relax and enjoy nature. It becomes the source for precious jewels, gold and silver, which people can make into jewelry and other beautiful things. It's the basis for building houses, cities, and roads. And also becomes the materials people use to build all those things for their comfort and livelihoods. Your two eyes then become the sun and the moon and provide light for all beings. Your flesh becomes food for all beings. Fruits, vegetables, bread, cheese, hummus, pizza, whatever they enjoy. Your skin becomes clothing and shoes that people can wear, protect them from the elements. So imagine all the people and beings enjoying these things, which have been transformed from the earth element of your body. Now think of the water element of the body. And this is mainly in our bodily fluids, like blood and other liquids in our body. But actually, the body is a huge percentage. I don't know, 75% water, maybe more. So imagine all that water element of our body absorbing into the external water element. And then this is used by beings for their survival and enjoyment. It becomes water and other delicious drinks, juice, Coca-Cola, tea, coffee, and so on. It becomes the water people use to irrigate their fields so they can grow their crops. And also nourish their thirsty animals, their cows and sheep and so on. To wash their clothes, clean their houses. And to make fountains and swimming pools where they can enjoy water sports. So really feel how the water element of your body has brought happiness to all beings. Next, imagine that the fire element of your body absorbs into the external fire element. So the fire element doesn't mean like flames, but it's heat, that quality of heat, warmth. So your fire element goes into the external fire element and brings happiness to other beings. It gives warmth to those who are cold. It provides energy so people can cook their food. Gives them light and energy to run their other devices and appliances. So really feel that the fire element of your body has brought happiness to all beings. And then there's the air element of the body. So this is responsible for breathing, of course, but also movement, the movement of our body, just walking and using our hands and so on. That involves the air element. And also the different bodily functions, digestion. So they rely on the air element, that subtle level of energy in the body. So imagine the air element of your body absorbing into the external air element, and then that benefits all beings. It gives them air to breathe, which most beings need in order to survive. And it becomes wind to provide energy. For example, places where they have windmills. And the air element also enables movement. It enables people and beings to walk, to run, do sports, and so on. So air is life and freedom. Let yourself be breathed in by all beings, providing life-sustaining oxygen to every cell in every being's body. So after giving to others now, imagine that all the suffering and the causes of suffering, like negative karma, afflictive emotions, of all beings ripens upon you. So all the beings become free of their suffering and causes of suffering, and allow that to absorb into your self-centered attitude, grasping at ego, I, mine. You can imagine that as a lump or black hole at your heart. All their suffering and causes of suffering absorb into that. And then they all disappear into emptiness. So your own self-centered attitude, ego, and the suffering and causes of suffering of others all dissolve into emptiness. The seemingly real I, which appears to exist from its own side, but doesn't, becomes empty. All that remains is the merely imputed I. And this I now dedicates all your merit and happiness to all beings. You can also dedicate all the merit of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and other beings. So a huge, vast ocean of merit, positive energy. Imagine giving this to all beings, and they receive it and it fulfills all their needs and wishes, both temporal and ultimate, up to enlightenment. We have 2 minutes left. Anybody has a question or comment or something to share? Yeah. I found it in one book, and I never did it by myself, but a few times I've done it with a group, and it's...
I personally would love a copy of that to practice with. It's really beautiful, and I imagine people watching might, too. I don't know if we could stick it in
the... email it.
Yeah, somehow. Post it somewhere. You can have access.